how do you distinguish between real life and social media life? And I think Kevin Durant is a great cultural flashpoint for this because so much of the coverage of Kevin Durant has recently dealt with his burner accounts, how he's responding to people on Instagram, how he's responding to people on Twitter. And yesterday for USA Basketball, he said, I got too many texts, or I talk too much on Instagram, or I talk too much on Twitter. I don't know how to talk to my teammates, or I'm angry or insecure or sensitive. Tell me what the real problem is, because every time I say something, I go about my business. And when I say something, y'all mash it up and run with it. And as soon as I say something back, I'm the sensitive one. I mean, I know y'all trying to make me look crazy and discredit me and strip me of my credibility, but I see what you're doing, but I'm going to keep standing. But the media is not really doing that to Kevin Durant. It's Kevin Durant doing it to Kevin Durant because I think he's gotten sucked into the funhouse mirror of social media and believing that it is real life as opposed to focusing on real life. And if Kevin Durant can get addicted to social media and sort of almost like Narcissus in the old Greek fable, fall into a reflection of himself into the water, he's the second best in the world at what he does. What does that say about the rest of us? For other people out there who are addicted to social media, has society evolved quickly enough to be able to understand what this is doing to us and the way that we should be able to handle it? Again, I was in my old college campus for the last couple of days at George Washington in D.C., and I was speaking to 800 high school kids, and I was thinking about how much different their experience is going to be. And I never say something is all good or all bad because I don't ever think it is. And certainly the benefits of social media are it allows you to stay in touch with all your friends and stay connected to them. But it can also allow you to build a universe for yourself that isn't in any way reflective of the real world. We're going to go to John Morosi. He is, I believe, just landed. He's racing around the country covering Major League Baseball. He usually talks to us once a week. He's going to join us now this morning. What's up, John? How are you doing?
Clay, greetings from the beautiful Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. I am en route to the great city of St. Louis. We've got a MLB Network telecast there today, so a busy week here in the trade deadline, and as I like to say, I will sleep in August, my friend.
So you're on your way to St. Why are you in, that doesn't seem like a very efficient way to travel. You usually live in Michigan, right? And then you went to Minnesota, and now you're headed to, are you waiting to fly? Or are you, this doesn't sound very appealing to drive from Minnesota to St. Louis.
So this is the old connection red eye. I'm coming from LA. I was in studio at Fox as of last night.
Yes.
For 4 days, four straight days there at Whip Around. On FS1 and making the red eye trip here to St. Louis for a little baseball game. So it's lots happening this week, but all in the name of our national pastime, which I am honored to be a part of.
So do you sleep on the red eyes? I hate red eyes. When I first started going out to LA, I mean, I live in Nashville, and there's a red eye that comes direct to Nashville that takes off whatever it is at midnight on the west coast. And lands at like 5 a.m. And I took it two or three times. And I found every time that I took it, I was more and more miserable because I couldn't fall asleep. And I didn't want, like, when I landed, all I wanted to do was just drive home and go to bed. And so I didn't feel like it was very efficient at all. Like, are you able to sleep on these things? Do you feel like they're efficient?
Yeah, I do. I'm a pretty decent red eye sleeper. And so
you're
feel
out.
Like if I. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say to our listeners, if you ever see me on a red eye, I'm the guy with the neck pillow and my glasses on. I'm pretty serious about just being as comfortable as I can be. Don't really care how it looks, and the goal is to be asleep by the time the plane takes off. That's usually how I'm trying to approach at least these red eyes.
All right, let's go into some baseball news. Aaron Judge, he is out 3 weeks. He's got the injury, the right wrist injury. How significant is this for the Yankees? 3 weeks would be roughly he'll be back, I don't know, what, late August we would think, mid to late August if everything went smooth. Is this going to be very substantial in the grand scheme of things? I know it stinks anytime you have an injury like this, but how are the Yankees equipped to handle it?
Well, Clay, I would say it two different ways. Now, number one, for the divisional race, this really is a substantial impediment for the Yankees in their goal to catch the Boston Red Sox in the AL East. They had just made the trade for J Happ earlier yesterday to get some momentum on their side, I would say. And of course, they just added Zach Britton. Britton made his Yankees debut last night. So there were some positive trends regarding those aspects of the roster. But then if you're going to lose Judge for this amount of time, I just think that given the Red Sox lead right now, the Yankees are playing for a wild card at this point in time unless something dramatic occurs. Now, they're going to be able to have Clint Frazier probably fill in for Aaron Judge in right field. I do not foresee a trade of Bryce Harper in this context, for example. I know it's a natural question to ask and ponder. I don't see that occurring here.
Would you trade him if you were the Nationals, though? Or are we going to end up in a situation where we talk a lot about this in the NBA, where a big-time free agent is coming up and then he just leaves? I'm not even aware exactly. And in the NBA, you get some advantages if somebody walks out on you like that from a salary cap perspective. I'm not even sure what happens in baseball where they don't really have a cap like that. Are the Nationals, in your mind, likely to be looking at Bryce Harper leaving and getting pretty much nothing in exchange if they can't persuade him to stay?
Well, yes. There is a draft pick, so you would get a draft pick. And in baseball, it's very important as well to get the amateur signing bonus slot allocation because there's only spot that really we have a salary cap in baseball is when you sign amateur players. So that is significant, but it's certainly not going to really be rising to the level of what Bryce Harper represents that franchise. I think here's how I look at that from the Nationals standpoint, Clay. The Nationals right now are far enough back that, in my opinion, the prudent thing to do is to trade Harper and trade just about any other pending free agent that they have and recoup whatever prospects they can at the moment and retool for next year and the years in the future. I don't think the Nationals will do that with Harper. They might trade their pending free agent relievers like Sean Kelly and Ryan Madsen, Kelvin Herrera, maybe even the rental starters like Gio Gonzalez and Jeremy Hellickson. But to trade Harper would be a pretty profound admission of the end of this era and or the fact they made some mistakes here in constructing this year's team. And in dismissing Dusty Baker after last season. So I think it would be a pretty startling admission of failure on the organization's part, which I don't really expect them to do. That being said, I think that given where they stand, that would be my advice to them. If I were sitting in next to GM Mike Rizzo, that's what I would tell him he should do. But, of course, it's easier for me or somebody in the media to say it versus actually trading a franchise player, even one who we should point out, Clay, in Harper's case, is not having an especially good season here this year with his offensive numbers.
How big? We didn't talk to you around the Major League Baseball All-Star break, but we came on and we talked quite a bit about the Home Run Derby and how big that could be for Bryce Harper, for his branding and everything else. And I know sometimes in the Home Run Derby, you have a guy who goes out and he loses his swing and he has trouble kind of recapturing it. At least that's the kind of cliche that's out there about why guys don't want to get into the Home Run Derby. But Harper had already lost his swing. What in the world is going on with him that he's hitting as poorly as he has? I mean, to drop 100 points and be healthy, it seems to be, is almost unheard of for a top player in Major League Baseball. Is this pressure he feels because his free agency is up? What do you, in your mind, is going on here with Bryce Harper in general? If he did get traded, do you think that would eliminate some of the concern? Is it really just the free agency hanging over his head? I know we're psychoanalyzing him, but it's rare to have a player this good diminish this much without major injury issues to point to.
Well, and that's a great question, and I think a very good point, Clay, about just the overall pressures that are on him right now. I thought he was going to have a monster year this year. I really did. I think that he has, at times in his career, become too susceptible to outside pitches and breaking pitches, where he can sometimes drift in the batter's box, as it appears to us on television or watching him in person, and he can have that sort of gradual pull away from the ball, which in modern times, Clay, with all the scouting information that teams have, once they see you do that, and if you've got pitchers that can execute location, the defensive and pitching team has the clear advantage right there once they know that you're vulnerable to a particular pitch in a particular location. And I think that's what's happened time and time again for Harper this particular season. Now, we saw in the Home Run Derby, it's not as though physically he has been sapped of his power, because he won the competition against the best, some of the best at least, power hitters in the game. So I think did so in a very dramatic way, and one that I think still speaks to his ability to embrace the moment in those cases where his superstar persona still shines through. So it's still there. It's still there, Clay. It's just, I think he has just become too predictable in terms of his approach, and teams have been able to exploit that. It's just a matter, I think, for him, maybe a different environment, maybe a different voice in terms of either manager, hitting coach, teammates. Maybe all those different things would sort of shock him back into being the player he's been in the past. I think actually that there is a pretty good school of thought behind that, because, again, we're sort of in a bit of psychoanalysis here, but I still think the ability is there. For whatever reason, it has not produced the results that we expected. All that being said, from talking to different agents and people around the game, and not even his agent, Scott Boras, this year, there are those that believe that based on the way that teams evaluate players nowadays, Clay, that Harper is still going to get a contract that is in the $250 million range, if not more, just simply based on his power, potential, and his young age. The fact that he's becoming a free agent at such a young age is a huge driver in player value in the way that modern teams with all their analytics evaluate players.
It is really interesting. And obviously Bryce Harper, I think in some way on the East Coast, is connected to Mike Trout on the West Coast. And you were saying you just came out of L.A., where it appears that the Angels are once again probably not going to be anywhere near the postseason. And we had a big, I would say, a kerfuffle surrounding this, the Mike Trout and what his impact is to baseball right now. Some people who are analytics guys would say Mike Trout has the potential to be one of the greatest baseball players of all time, yet I still feel he's a bit of an enigma to many people out there. They don't really feel like they know him very well, and he certainly doesn't get very much attention. And we, on this show this week, we're talking about baseball's challenge to create superstars. If you were, you know, Rob Manfred, and obviously he got into it a little bit in terms of what could happen with Trout to make him a superstar, don't the Angels need to trade Mike Trout almost for the betterment of baseball to get him on a team that matters, that could make the postseason, for people then to be able to become aware of how talented this guy is? Because if he's not in postseason baseball, it's hard for him to become a national figure playing for a team that, frankly, I mean, look, the Dodgers and the Angels, there's a big difference between the Dodgers and the Angels. The Angels are, I would say, even though they're in the L.A. area, sort of in the backwater of the media environment compared to the Dodgers. And as a result, it's crazy to say, because he's in the second biggest city in America, it feels like Trout's just kind of slipping beneath the radar.
Well, you make some very good points, Clay. I think first and foremost, I'll start with this. He has only 2 years after this year before he becomes a free agent. And the Angels, this is surprising to say, but it's the truth. The Angels have not won a playoff series since defeating the Boston Red Sox in the first round in 2009. It's the last time the Angels won a playoff series,
yeah,
which is hard to say. Mike Trout has played in 3 playoff games. The Angels have lost them all. He had 2 opportunities to play in the World Baseball Classic and declined both of them. So that's one other platform where you can have sustained exposure to the American viewer over a period of time. And, of course, Team USA won it in 2017 without him. I think that there's a lot there. I think that are the Angels, from a competitive standpoint, wasting Mike Trout's prime? You could argue that they are. I mean, this is a team that has been close at different times, but has never quite had, at least in Trout's time, the dominant rotation to win in what has become a very competitive division. And now you look at the way the Astros are playing, and certainly the A's and the Mariners, this is a really tough division. And the Angels, in my judgment, don't have the total club to compete with certainly the defending World Series champions in Houston. Should the Angels look at this through the lens of altruism and trade them to a team that's going to have a chance to to sort of full, use his full ability for the betterment of baseball's marketing and overall platform for the sport. I don't think they're obligated to do that, but I think it's a reality, Clay, that as we're talking here today, that the best years of his career are not being spent on a team that's using his full capabilities to the betterment of both their own brand and also the brand of the sport. I think that is an absolute truth. And I think in general, I always give baseball, and in this case, the player and the team, a bit of a pass on the overall marketing question, because to ask a fan who lives in New England or in New York or Nashville or Michigan or anywhere to be a devoted fan of the Angels, it's you're asking them to root for a team and stay up late to watch a team play beyond rooting for their local team, which in baseball, if you're going to spend 20 hours a week to watch your own team and then 20 more to watch the Angels every night, that's 40 hours. That's a full-time job. And yeah, people have families and other obligations, whereas it's hard to do that. So I think that the structure of the game is hard to make a star in your own life of a player on a team that's not your team. And I think that's why, to your point, Clay, very astutely, Derek Jeter does not become Derek Jeter unless the New York Yankees are in the playoffs and frequently the World Series every year, it seemed, during the early years of his career. That was an absolutely integral part of Derek Jeter becoming the player and the person that he became, with the Yankees winning every single year. And Mike Trout has simply not had that very same opportunity.
Outstanding stuff as always, John Morosi. Quickly, because we got to hit the update here. Who's going to win the NL West? This is the most competitive division in all of baseball right now. Right now, there are four teams within 5.5. The Giants, everybody is still in the mix. The Giants are only 5.5 out. But who do you think is going to win the NL West?
I have the Dodgers winning the NL West despite some of their, I think, pitching deficits with their injuries earlier in the season. I love the Machado acquisition. I think they find a way to get one more reliever and form a better bridge to Kenley Jansen. And I think, in general, the Dodgers right now have the best 1-25 roster, certainly in their division and maybe in the National League as well.
Outstanding stuff as always. Get some sleep at some point. Great work. That is John Morosi. The story and the impact of sports journalism and journalism at large. New York Daily News, a massive newspaper that's had a long history of educating a large group of people in our nation's biggest media market, New York City. And Frank Isola does Around the Horn, but I've been reading him at the New York Daily News for a long time. And I think he's done good work there. And your statement, Frank, he joins us now. Your statement that you put out when the firings happened, and I believe I'm correct in this. You can correct me if I'm wrong. 25 out of the 34 people who worked in the sports department were let go in one fell swoop. What did that feel like? What did it tell you about the future of sports journalism in general and maybe journalism as a whole? And thanks for joining us, by the way, early this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Clay. Good talking to you. Yeah, it was kind of odd. I'd never been laid off or fired from a job before. And, you know, when you spend 25 years there, especially when, you know, and before I started working there, I didn't have kids and things like that. So even my kids kind of grew up with me working there. So that part of it was odd. But, you know, we all kind of saw this coming. I still find it hard to believe, like, in a city like New York, and you see Rupert Murdoch with the New York Post, they might be losing money, but there's something, you know, he has a big enough wallet, a big enough ego, where he wants to have a newspaper. And I always thought you could, or I always felt there would be someone in New York with enough money, and once again, enough, a big enough ego, where they would want to run a newspaper. They like the cachet that comes with that. And, you know, the New York Daily News, you know, next year is their 100th birthday. Who knows if it's going to survive to be 100? I find that if you had asked me 20 years ago, I would have thought the Daily News would stick around for maybe another 50 years, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
For a lot of people out there, they hear, I mean, I think the New York Daily News has a big brand. Like you said, it's nearly 100 years old. When did you start to think, uh-oh, we might be in trouble? Because there's been this discussion, the slow drip of the impact of the internet and the decision by many newspapers to give away their content online and everything else. And we've seen slowly a lot of jobs be lost year after year after year. Was there a moment when you had your job and you sat around and you thought, hey, we might be in trouble here? Do you remember that first moment of crystallization of thought? Or did you always think, because of the history of the newspaper, like you just mentioned, that there's always going to be somebody who wants to own and run this thing?
Yeah, I would say 3 years ago when they started laying off a lot of people. By the time I got laid off on Monday, I was the fourth longest tenured person in the sports department, which is almost hard to believe. You know, 10, 12 years ago, we had 65 people working in the sports department. Up until Monday, we had 35. So that's a big slash right there, from 65 to 35. But about 3 years ago, and they got rid of a lot of good people, and they got rid of people, yeah, they were probably, you know, they were older, so they were probably making more money, but they were quality people. And if you're not interested in putting out a quality product, that's going to be scary. But come on, Clay, you know how it works. I mean, when you're on the New York City subway, you know, it used to be people reading the newspaper. You go on the New York City subway, I would always look around a car and start counting how many people are reading a newspaper. And if they are, they might not be reading the Daily News. They could be reading the New York Times or the New York Post. So people just don't read newspapers like they once did. And like you said, the content is for free online, and you have a younger generation of people coming up who are always on their phone. They're not interested in buying a newspaper.
What would you tell? I get asked this question a lot, and I don't have a good answer. I'm curious if you have one. So we're both, I'm 39. You're older than that. You've made a living as a writer. I feel like I've made a good living as a writer. Transitioned into radio. You've transitioned to TV. We're going to be fine, right? Like in our careers, in our life, you do a great job on Around the Horn. What about kids out there now? I bet you get asked this question now, who are 20 and in college, and they want to one day do some of the things that we do, and they're coming at it from the writing perspective. What would you tell them?
Yeah, I do get asked that a lot, and I do a radio show also on Sirius, so I'm doing kind of the same thing that you're doing, and I think we've done it in a smart way. I think it's good to have that writing base, and I think if you're in college, you know, try to write for the school newspaper. Just write as much as you can, because I also think there's plenty of writing jobs out there. They're just not necessarily in the newspaper business. And I think for you, I'm sure being a columnist before and writing, I think it gives you, when you're doing radio and you're doing TV, I think you probably find it easier for you to formulate a story, know what a story is, and kind of know how to put it together. So I think having that writing base is always very good, and then you can kind of branch into the other things. But there's no doubt about it. And I heard you yesterday on the internet talking about how, you know, there was a period where you decided, you know what, I have to start branching out and doing other things. And I've been doing that as well for the past, you know, I guess it's been about 4 or 5 years. And thankfully I have, because I've lost that job. I'm going to have to move down to Nashville with you. Maybe I'll cover the MLS team that's coming into the league.
Oh, we're talking to Frank Isola. I mean, he does tremendous work. I am, and this is something that I think is also instructive. As somebody who has done writing, radio, and TV, I want to get your opinion on this, but I also want to share it for everybody out there. I think by far writing is the hardest. I think radio is the second hardest. I think TV by far is the easiest. And the reason why I would say that is, ultimately, on the writing, even if you have a good editor, even if you got somebody helping you, it's you sitting in front of a blank screen having to create something out of nothing. Radio, I've got people who can help me here. It's still just a lot of space to fill. I've got 3 hours every day, even if there's not major news. TV, and I'm sure you hear this a lot Around the Horn too, you sit down, you do it for 23 minutes, you get done, and people are like, that was amazing. And you go back and you're like, I talked for 4 minutes and 15 seconds total on the show today, right? And there's a lot of other people out there. There's production staff trying to make sure you have the right facts and the right data and everything. I'm like, where are these people when I'm writing my new book trying to make sure I get every factor at it, right? There's 20 people who make sure that I know how many games Kobe Bryant's won in a row. And then, you know, I got 100,000 words that I'm cranking out here, and hardly anybody is helping me with it at all. Do you feel that same way having done all three? They're obviously different disciplines, but do you feel the same way that I do about difficulty?
Definitely. And I also think, too, in TV, it's funny, right? Whenever you get off the air, great job, great. You guys did great. I'm always thinking to myself, what am I, Johnny Carson? I've done that great. When you're in a newspaper, the feedback in radio, I think the feedback is different as well. The newspaper part of it and the writing part of it, I should say, is more difficult, but I always felt it was more satisfying too. I think you know when you wrote a good column, a good story, and you always felt that it had more impact. And I know on radio you can go off a little bit and really have some good takes, but there's just something different about putting it down, in words on your computer, and it comes out either on the internet or on a newspaper. I always felt that was the most enjoyable. And it was fun. You know, you cover a team like the Knicks, which is a big team, and they have some big-time players, and the organization's pretty dysfunctional. So, you know, they always provided pretty good content for me. And I got to branch out and do some other stuff. So in a place like New York where, you know, we have two of everything, you know, one bad team, one good team in all of the sports. And so there was always plenty of things to write about. I always felt the writing definitely was harder. And let's face it too, Clay, as, you know, there's more competition, you know, with radio and TV, these teams, after a while, they get to the point where, like, you know what, we don't really need these reporters. We don't really need the newspaper guys to kind of get our message out there. So even the access gets cut a little bit, and that makes it even more challenging. And that's actually in a good way. You should be a better reporter because of it. And I had a buddy of mine tell me, who I covered the Mets with him a million years ago at the New York Times. He told me, if you don't have people that are mad at you, you're not doing a good job. And that doesn't mean just purposely go out and destroy people. You should try to be fair, but if you're doing a fair, honest job, there are going to be people that are mad at you.
The best analogy I can have for writing a good column or writing a good article is, from the world of sports, is it's like, I don't get to do it very often, but when I golf and I hit a good drive, and you just get to watch it as it's majestically kind of soaring down the center of the fairway, and you're like, man, I wish I could do this every time. You don't always do that, right? Sometimes you have a single. Sometimes you get a check swing. You know, you hit a foul ball. Like, everybody has to stand up there. But when you do a really good column and you feel like you nailed it, that's the feeling that I would always have, is the same one when you just hit a golf ball perfectly, however well you can hit it. You mentioned something about New York, growing up in New York, and I went away to college in Washington, D.C., and one of the first cultural touchstones to me was getting to read Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon in the Washington Post. And what I have found when I travel, I'm 39, but I've always been a newspaper guy. I still get two newspapers delivered to my house, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, every day. I still like to physically read the newspaper. One of the things I loved when I was a kid and I got to make my first trip to New York City was the degree to which the city was enmeshed in news, and the way you could go grab a bunch of different newspapers and get so many different perspectives. I felt the same thing when I was in college and I got to go overseas in London, the way that that city had so many different newspapers they would produce. I just loved reading them, information, everything else. The city and the newspaper seem sort of inextricably intertwined. As a New Yorker with the New York Daily News declining, like you said, it's almost 100 years old, does that feel in some way like the city is losing out? Because the city, to me, the newspaper helps to reflect the culture of that city, and I don't know necessarily, as you move across the country now, that you still have that feeling where the city and the newspaper are connected.
Yeah, that's a great point, especially when you talk about London, you know, being over there for the Olympics, and I've made a couple of other trips over there, and when you go to that newsstand and you see all those newspapers, it's great.
Well, it's amazing. Yes.
It just feels like a newspaper town when you're there. It's really cool. And the back pages, and, you know, I like soccer, and of course a lot of the back pages there have soccer on it, but it's just the way that they go about presenting it. It's really interesting. And clearly the two tabloids in New York, the New York Post and the New York Daily News, tried to take after that. And there was something about, you know, going by the newsstand and you see a back page, especially if I'm up in the morning and it was a story that I had written the night before and it's on the back page. That's a pretty cool feeling. But I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, the New York Post, I actually believe that they've done a better job over the past 10 years kind of increasing their coverage. And the product that they're putting out, I believe, is better today than it probably was 20 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. But there is something to be said when the two newspapers are kind of competing and they're trying to hold people accountable, whether that's City Hall, the crime in the streets, the Yankees, the Mets, the Knicks. There's something about that. And I definitely think we're losing that now because the Daily News, unfortunately, just isn't what it once was.
How has your life changed by going on television?
It changes it. In a lot of ways. It's good because it clearly increases your profile. The big thing with me was Twitter happening, because I'm a bit of a wise guy. So when Twitter started, it was kind of a good vehicle for me. So that really increased my profile as well. So it was like the combination of the Daily News and Twitter. Then my guy Tony Reale, yes, he was the one that reached out to me about Around the Horn, which was good. But you know how it is on TV. Yeah. The feedback you get on TV was, you look ugly, you look like this. A lot of people, it's mostly about like the way you look, which is,
yeah,
that's why
cosmetic.
To do TV, right, to do TV 5 days a week, I give a lot of these people credit. I don't know how especially people who are on some of these morning shows, I don't know how they do it. But it definitely changes your life. My kids get a kick out of it because they're always busting on me. You know, I just had a son graduate college, my daughter is in college. And if you have people come up to you on the street, which I'm sure you get, if for my kids, they used to think it was odd. Now they just laugh at it. They just can't believe that anybody would come up to me and tell me that they saw me on TV. I think that part of it is kind of interesting. But it's helped. Everything now is about building your brand, and I'm sure you've done a great job with it, whether it's Twitter and, you have your radio show, and are you going to be on TV again, and the thing you do on the where do you do that from? Every time when you have – is that from your house?
Yeah, I have created my house because I've got a 10, a 7, and a 3-year-old here. So my goal when we moved into this new house, I told my wife, I said, I want an area that is just like my domain, my office. So I have a whole floor here where I can do writing, where I can do radio, where I can do TV, where I can literally move for like 5 feet and do everything. So it's just so much more efficient for me trying to balance out having three kids and everything else to be able to be all in one place. Because otherwise, you just end up, I feel like, traveling from one place to the other, and you're never able to be that efficient.
Yeah, no, you do a good job with that. And the TV part of it, it obviously helped put my kids through school, which is good. It's fun, and it's... sometimes can be challenging, but for the most part, I always just feel weird when I'm on TV, because when I'm sitting home watching TV, I'm the guy that's sitting there making fun of people.
Yes.
Every time I'm on, I'm thinking to myself, I know there's a lot of people sitting watching TV making fun of me right now. That part of it always kind of gets me a little bit.
Is sports better now? You've been doing it for a while. Do you like sports better now or when you first got your first job in sports? And in particular, how has social media, in your mind, impacted that opinion?
I still love the games. I just think the way everything is covered now is a lot different. I think today it's more about access than actually covering people. Like, for example, like a guy like LeBron, who I think kind of keeps score on who is criticizing me, who's kind of on my side. I just don't think there's enough, reporting anymore or looking at things with a critical eye. For example, like the LeBron thing. If I have to read one more time how Magic Johnson drove to LeBron's house on June 30th and they had this incredible meeting, and that's the reason why LeBron went there. Come on, Clay.
Yeah.
Did we all think LeBron was going there a year ago?
Yes.
So it just seems like today we seem to go along with everything a little bit more. Oh, yeah, that's right. Magic saying it and LeBron... is saying it, so let's go along with this story. Come on, we knew for a year ago. And I think that's how the media has changed a little bit. I think it's a little too much of an access business, where that's all everybody is concerned about. And to the players' credit, especially in a league like the NBA, I think the players have become so powerful where they've made it kind of an access business. You're either on my side or you're not on my side. If you're not on my side, I'm not dealing with you.
I'd love to get you on sometime for like 30 or 45 minutes in a row all at once, because I think we could have some awesome conversations. I think you do outstanding work. Go follow him on Twitter. I tweeted out the link if you're not already, at the Frank Isola. He's obviously on Around the Horn, New York Daily News. He's got Sirius XM. This is outstanding. I really appreciate it, man.
All right, Clay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Have you guys seen this? Somebody just tweeted this to me, and I could not believe it. They have put out, and this is real life, I'm not making this up, the country, and I want to make sure I get the country right, because this is like Sweden and Switzerland. I can't tell them apart. The State Department has issued, the United States State Department has issued a travel warning because people there believe that the area is being overrun by vampires. And maybe it is. Maybe zombies and vampires have finally arrived. This is a real thing from the State Department. Hashtag Malawi. Malawi? Malawi. How do you pronounce that country? Does anybody know Malawi?
How do you spell it?
Malawi. Security alert. And by the way, when I retweeted this, I accidentally said it was happening in Mali. So I got Malawi and Malawi confused. And evidently, those are two different places. Again, this goes back to my point. There needs to be a central authority in charge of naming countries, where you can't name countries that sound too much like they're the same. Sweden and Switzerland should never be able to happen. Uruguay and Paraguay shouldn't be able to happen. You shouldn't be able to confuse people like this. Everybody out there is going to be totally confused at the difference between Malawi and Mali. I can't tell the difference already. This is real life. There is a restriction on embassy staff who is allowed to travel there because rumors of attacks by human bloodsuckers have led to acts of vigilante justice. They are fighting vampires, they believe, right now in Malawi. This is a real State Department travel advisory.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now.
It's in southeastern Africa.
Malawi is?
Yes.
What about Mali?
I don't know. I have Malawi.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. But what about Mali? Where is Mali? That's a country, too. Is that in the same continent, or is it in a different continent?
I'm looking that up right now.
Yeah, I don't know the difference between Malawi and Mali. But, again, I'm sorry if you were, like, if you saw my tweet, I tweeted it out during a commercial break. If I got people panicked in Mali because the vampires are actually in Malawi, all you need to know is if they're in Malawi, they're eventually going to be in Mali. This could be the start of The Walking Dead. They had zombies. We got vampires. Again, this, I swear to God, this is an official travel alert. Temporary restrictions on embassy staff due to an abundance of caution because of rumors of attacks by human bloodsuckers in villages of rural southern Malawi that have led to acts of vigilante justice. This is from our United States government.
Mali is in West Africa.
So they're both in Africa.
Yes.
I'm totally correct. They're going to spread. The vampires are everywhere.